Isaiah 40.
What a great text.
We talked a little bit about, I don't want to redo the eisegetics, but as you know, Isaiah 40 begins in most analyses the second half of the book of Isaiah. Most critical scholars, you know, divide the book into at least three discrete units, Isaiah 1, 2, and 3, written by different people at different times. The contemporary version of this theory really is much more complicated than that and sees about seven redactional levels of recasting the whole book of Isaiah. So it's not so much 1st Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah, and 3rd Isaiah as different versions of the whole book of Isaiah, which is kind of an interesting way of looking at it. I mentioned, too, in our little section, just by way of introduction, that a lot of more contemporary commentaries are dividing the book not at 39:40, but at 33:34. In fact, I noticed on the program of the SBL meeting coming up here in 2 weeks, that they're having the Isaiah section is going to feature, I guess, the republication or second edition of James Watt's commentary in the Word series, which is a two-volume commentary on the whole book of Isaiah that was the first major commentary to divide it at 33:34. I'll have to get this from Robbie because I'm not getting there until after this section is there. I'm really disappointed, but I'm anxious to hear what they say about this and whether Watts. Do you, any of you know his commentary in the Word series? It's not bad. He was one of the first guys to really try to read the book holistically, but he's got this really wacky theory of it being a divine drama of some sort. He's actually, if you read his commentary, it's like reading Shakespeare where you're a pet play, where you've got along the margin narrator, chorus, person one, prophet, voice of God. I mean, he's sort of divine. And he's told me, or told in a lecture, that he actually has his students perform the book of Isaiah as a drama. Which is kind of an interesting theory, but man, let me say this nicely. It's one of those theories that hasn't gained a whole lot of support. And I don't know if the second edition is perpetuating that or he's gone on to other things or not. All that by way of introduction, Isaiah 40 is often compared to Isaiah 6 as a secondary call narrative. Now, you don't have to hold to two Isaiahs or three Isaiahs, which would assume that this is the call of 2nd Isaiah, in the same way that Isaiah 6 may have been the call of 1st Isaiah, to argue that this is somewhat of a reinvigoration of the mission. And even conservatives who would argue for a unity of not only the book, but of the authorship of the book, which are two different questions, remember, would have to argue that there is sort of a shift in focus here at 40, if for no other reason, and it's not just moving from law to gospel, but sort of from a major theme of judgment to a major theme of salvation, even though the first half has plenty of salvation and the second half has plenty of judgment, but also a purview from the Assyrian problem to the Babylonian situation, because Babylon is mentioned rather specifically. Now again, your textbooks, your commentaries will argue whether the Babylon in 2nd Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah in quotes, so to speak, is the Babylon of the 6th century or the 8th century, or a very generic understanding of Baal, which stands for all that is opposed to the right way of the people of God ever since Genesis 11, with the Tower of Baal. It's the same word, of course, Babylon. So in that sense, Babylon is much more than any specific historicized manifestation of the earthly forces opposed to the kingdom of God, which isn't a bad translation of Babylon. But having said that, let's turn to the text. Okay. Nachmu, Nachmu, Ami. Pars Nachmu, PL imperative, second masculine, plural. Now, did you talk about why it's plural? At least observe that it's a plural form. By the way, this repetition of imperatives is characteristic of the second half of the book. You get this a lot, where he says an imperative twice. Sort of his version of amen, amen. by saying it twice, Nachmu, Nachmu, Ami. But this is a great isagogical, or actually it's an exegetical interpretive question. If this is plural, to whom is it addressed? Who do you think? Whom do you think? Well, see, the first thing is, it can't be simply Isaiah, right? Because it's plural, right? We're not talking about the prophet in a singular. I'll give you the three candidates. One is, and probably the most obvious, is that God is talking to the cherubim, a cherubim and the seraphim, or the angels and archangels and all the company of heaven, who were hovering around. Remember, they were oofing in the polale there in chapter 6, flying to and fro in this very powerful, active description of heaven, that maybe the divine messengers, you see, that God is now commanding to go and comfort my people. So it's the heavenly hosts, the Tzavoth of Yahweh Tzavoth. A second theory, and one that fits our way of putting all these pieces together very well in terms of prophecy fulfillment, is if not Isaiah, then Isaiah and all the prophets. So that Isaiah is already, or God is already looking beyond Isaiah to say that there will be those coming after him within the prophetic train, to use an old metaphor, and to switch metaphors, the caboose of which is, who's the last car on the prophetic train? John the Baptist, right? So the application or the fulfillment of these words in John the Baptist as the last one who comes as a voice crying in the wilderness fits that idea very well. So in that sense, we're moving beyond the singular Isaiah and his times to see this as a process that goes on into the future, and now we can say sort of culminates in the citation of this text with reference to John the Baptist. The third possibility that's often cited, though this is the least likely but most interesting, is that the imperative here is the same imperative as you get in chapter 34. Now that would assume that chapter 34 begins the second half of the book, you see. And chapter 34 is addressed to the nations. The nations who were called on to destroy Jerusalem are now, great reversal, called on to bring comfort and salvation to God's people, which is, after all, what happens when Cyrus releases them, if you will, conquers Babylon, and sends them home. So that's at least another possibility. In any case, parse it correctly. Comfort, comfort my people, says, again, I think we generally translated the great poetic imperfect here as a present tense. And the problem of verb tense is still there. So says your God, speak. Now, all these imperatives are consistently plural, right? P-A-L, speak upon the heart of Jerusalem and proclaim. Kara really means proclaim. It's probably the closest verb you get to preach in the kerusein sense of the Greek, to proclaim, to be a messenger with a proclamatory message. Proclaim to her. And then look, you got three imperatives, and then you get three keys. Do you remember the three keys in chapter 6? Another sort of stylistic literary parallel here. Proclaim to her. Now, we debated in our section whether the key here is indirect discourse or subordinate clause with a causal relationship, because key can mean that, and remember that works in indirect discourse, or is the key of because. And frankly, you can make either one work here. I don't know, Dale, did you guys talk about that? What'd you conclude? Oh, you're going to ask me, were you? Well, again, you can make it work either way. I think the natural reading of the text, and I think most English translations follow this, is to take the key here as indirect discourse. As in, I know that my Redeemer lives. proclaim to her that, in other words, instead of comma, quote, it's indirect, that, though you can make the case, you should proclaim, cry out to her, but then it's never clear what it is you proclaim. Just cry out to her something, probably something good, because all of this stuff is true. Or take it as the indirect discourse. Cry out to her that her tzava is full up. Now, we at least paused to comment on mala'a. Here's the problem. It's kind of an interesting text-critical issue, but not nearly as much fun as verse 6. You can let this ride as, how'd you parse this? Kal, perfect, third singular feminine, right? Which would make sense only if tzava is feminine. Technically, tzava is masculine, even though the plural is tzavaoth, which would make you think, well, maybe they thought it was feminine too. And there are nouns like this that sort of show up in both genders, so that can happen. The other way is to read it as with the footnote, which is kind of interesting. Well, actually, there's two suggestions in the footnote, right? One is to read it with Qumran, which simply sees it as Malay, as a third singular masculine, right, without the comments, hey. The other is their suggestion, no text, but PRP means propositum, which being Latin means it is proposed or suggested as a way of repointing. You see, that's kept the consonants the same but simply repointed it to a pe'el. So now in this suggestion the subject would be feminine, but it would not be her warfare is full, but she, that is Jerusalem, has pe'el, fulfilled her time of service. What's interesting, you can make any of these work. And I think most translations, again, kind of go back to the default mode, which is try to make sense out of the Masoretic text, even though Qumran, you see, would support the fact of reading this as masculine, that her warfare, masculine, is full, masculine. That makes sense. In which case, you got just a text-critical decision between reading this verb or this verb with an extra comment, hey. Right? You're really asking, okay, if you're going to assume that somehow here tzava was perceived as a feminine noun, even though technically it's not, where else, are there other attested cases where this has happened, and how would you find that out? This is why you use a right. Well, Bible Works is a form of a concordance, right? And there's nothing wrong with using some high-tech concordance, right? You go find, look it up, and something, though somewhere, someone will have run the tapes on this and can tell you, you should be able to ask a computer program this question, right? Where else is tzava used with a masculine verb, right? There's got to be a way to ask the search that question, and you'd find out. Otherwise, you just do it the old-fashioned way and look up a concordance and go through all the text. But that's a helpful piece of information, right? If you say, oh yeah, this happened at least, you know, a half a dozen other places, and most of them are in Isaiah. See, that would even be more evidence to say that maybe in Isaiah's world, this noun was as much masculine as it is feminine or something like that. So those are good thinking. All right, that her time of warfare is full, that her awon has been ratzad. Right? Nifal, perfect, third singular, masculine. Is that right? No. Yes. Nifal, perfect, third singular, masculine. Not feminine. Here the comments, hey, is masculine. From ratzah, which means to be, in a sense, a paraphrase, to be declared acceptable through sacrifice. I mean, there are sacrificial overtones here. To be declared acceptable. Her iniquity. It's interesting that in biblical thought, the word for sacrifice and the sacrifice itself are often assumed to be the same, in a sense, almost have the same referent as the sin for which the sacrifice is made. So if the sacrifice is acceptable, the sin is acceptable. If the sin has been declared, it's not acceptable in the sense that it's okay, but it's been made propitiation for. It's been declared forgiven. That is through the sacrifice. I mean, that's what's behind that passage. But he was made sin for us who knew no sin. That the sacrificial person in this case is actually called the sin as well as the sacrifice. That those two concepts obviously overlap because that's what's going on there. Well, that's an aside. That she has taken or received Miyad Yahweh, Kiflayim, a double, a nice dual form, literally in all her sins, right? Any questions on this? Note, by the way, the nice word pair between Awon and Katath. This is a nice word pair. And we had it, or again, in Isaiah 6, right? Her iniquity is removed. Do I have them in the right order? I might have them backwards, right? Her iniquity is removed. Her sin is atoned. But Katath and Awon. If anything, Katath is more the individual sins. And Awon is more the condition of being sinful. So sinfulness, from which comes individual kataths. Question, Mike? Katoth, right? That is the plural form here. Do you see? All you see is that little O, but it is plural, right? It's a feminine noun. Katath, katoth. The quiescent aleph is what's making it goofy for you. All right, now we get to verse 3. Kol korei. We talked about this. How do you parse korei? Korei is easy to parse. Participle, masculine, singular. How did you translate kol korei? All right, explain the grammar of that. How are you understanding the participle here? Part of speech. Adjective, noun, verb. What kind of adjective? Predicate or attributive? All right, say it again. Translate it now. I think you're right. Yeah, a proclaiming voice or a voice proclaiming. All right? Give me another way to do it. Think of another way somebody might take this and still be right. It could be a voice proclaiming. Remember, it could be a predicate. It could not only attribute an adjective, it could be a predicate adjective. A voice is crying, right? There's actually a third way, and that would be, anyone got it? You take korei as a substantive, a voice of construct chain, a voice of a crying guy, or a voice of one crying. That's, in fact, the way it's usually taken in English, right? The voice of one crying. Now, the next problem here, of course, is how do you divide this line up, right? Because in this is a nice piece of Hebrew poetry, a voice of one crying, and you'll see the minor pause or accent mark there. In the Hebrew poetry, it's clear that you now have this followed by a this is almost a classic. We talked about, I think, just the literary construction of this verse as a couplet, right? Bamidbar panu, derek Yahweh, yashurub arva miselah leloheinu. Just analyze the poetry here of parallelism, right? What goes with Bamidbar? Barava. What matches Panu? How can I do this? Panu Yashru, right? So that's an ABBA pattern. That's called a chiasm, all right? Where you have, well, an X. Duh. What's the parallel to Yahweh, to Derek? Misalah, and the parallel to Yahweh is Eloheinu. So in the second line, you have a linear relationship. Do you see what's going on here? I mean, this is just good stuff. And like I say, once in a while, you got to stop and smell the roses. These guys, Isaiah in particular, was just a literary genius. I mean, these guys are actually good. This is one of my great hopes is to teach in a secular college, to teach a course on the Bible as literature, which is a way of getting people to study the Bible without having to say it's the Word of God. There's a lot of good stuff you can talk about just in terms of literature here. And of course, now, so a voice is crying, and again, these imperatives are plural, right? So whoever he's talking to, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. make straight in the Arabah in the desert, though this is the actual technical term for the desert south of the Dead Sea, but it becomes part for the whole in terms of desert region, in the prepare in the Arabah a highway for God. Just at least, we don't have time to chase this rabbit, but you at least have to observe that when this text gets quoted in Matthew, what's different? Yeah, in Matthew, the in the wilderness goes with a voice crying. So the neat poetic parallelism is gone. Now the trouble is it was gone already in the Septuagint. And the New Testament is essentially quoting the Septuagint here. But it does slightly change the text. It's not a voice crying, comma, quote, in the wilderness prepare. It's a voice crying in the wilderness. So the voice is already in the wilderness, comma, quote, prepare the way of the Lord. Well, you can figure out what to do with that when you teach this in Bible class. It's kind of ironic that if John the Baptist is the last guy to whom was being said, prepare the way of the Lord in the wilderness, he now becomes the voice in the wilderness because he did what the prophecy said, and that's to be in the wilderness and prepare the way of the Lord. I mean, you can kind of make that work. It's kind of intriguing, actually. It could be that the Septuagint just didn't quite appreciate Hebrew poetry as much. I don't know. All right, verse 4. Well, this is hard because of the vocabulary, but easy because you know it by memory. Every gay will be lifted up, nice niphal, imperfect, right? And every mountain and hill will be shephaled, will be leveled out. That's what shephal really means, to be. I talked about the Shephelah as a place name, one of the geographic areas of the, where the hill country comes down to the coastal plain. That's the Shephelah. And the idiom of Hayah plus Lamed means to become. So the rough place will become a plain, a Mishor. This is the same root, Yashar. Do you see that? In Mishor, this is the same Yashar that you had up here in the verb Yashar, right? So we'll become a Mishar, and the rugged terrain will become a Beka. Beka means a broad, almost fertile plain valley. Okay. And now we get to the punchline, verse 5. The Kavoz Yahweh will be Galad in the Niphal, perfect, third singular, masculine. Remember, all third hays have a comet's hay in the masculine, so don't get confused by the comet's hay here. It's masculine. And the Kavoz Yahweh will be Galad, and all Basar will see. It's interesting, all Basar is technically singular, but the verb Ra'u is clearly perfect, third, plural, while consecutive, and all Basar will see together. So Kol Basar is one of those great collective terms for everybody. All flesh will see it together. Ki pi Yahweh daber. That's just a great closing line, huh? For the mouth. Oh, I have to correct. Last week I made the mistake of translating pi as lips. Didn't I do that in Isaiah 6? Somebody called me on it after class, and you were absolutely right. I just misspoke myself. I said something about, this has touched your... I forget what I said, but I got it wrong. P is mouth, Safa is lip, all right? So whatever I said in that whole sermon, whenever I meant gospel, I meant law. Just go back and make the changes and it'll be fine. Verse 6, Kol Omer, is this the same Kol that we had here? See, now you're asking the exegetical question. Now we have another Kol, is this the same Kol? Are these the Kols of the one crying that we had in chapter 6? Where one group called to the other, Kavoz, Kadosh, 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 Yahweh Tzivaoth, holy, 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 all the earth, the filling of all the earth is his Kavodah. We have this antiphon going back and forth, right? Great taste, less filling. More taste, less... Is that what's going on here, where you have this sort of divine... That's why we sing psalms this way even today. Did you ever think about that? It's because of Isaiah 6. whether it's pastor people or lectern pulpit or choir people, but we're sort of filling and echoing, sounding and resounding the praises of Yahweh in every which way we can make it work to fill up the place with the praises of God. A voice of one saying, one thing is clear here, this is now singular, right? Suddenly we've moved from the plural to the singular. Is this Isaiah himself? Is this the prophet? So a voice of one saying to one guy, cry out. So now it's become personal, it's become individual. If this is kind of the larger mission of the whole, this is now this particular mission of the one. Cry. And he said, what shall I cry? Now you've got a great text critical note that I will take a minute or two to comment on with Amar. And here, I don't know if you got an English translation handy. I know you'll see variations in the English translations. There are those that read, a voice said, cry, and he said, what shall I cry? Who's the he of the he said here? Yeah, the only thing that makes sense is that you've got the antiphon going. So one cry side goes, cry out. The other side says, what shall I cry? Except now they each put one guy forward to be sort of the representative, and one guy says, cry. And the other guy says, what shall I cry? Because it's I, singular. Well, that can work. But look at, you'll also see English translations that translate, a voice is saying, cry, and I said, what shall I cry? Now, you got to parse this as perfect third singular masculine. So where do you get the first singular common if it's I cried? Answer? Look at the footnote right there. All right? Again, we're not getting into this. That's not the nature of this course, but you should at least begin to look at the footnotes. The critical apparatus that shows you variant ratings. QA means Qumran, A, Isaiah A scroll. It's the main great Isaiah scroll. And look what it has. Can you parse Omerah? Sight unseen. Granted, it's not pointed. You see that wow is going to be in holam. So essentially it's Omar. What is interesting is that it's got a kamate on the end, which would make it cohortative. This is actually a cohortative form. Now, that's not quite as neat either. A voice cries, cry, and let me say, what shall I cry? But it does introduce the first person as a legitimate option. It's clear that O, remember that's that old problem of the imperfects of first alephs, where you get Yomar, Tomar, Tomar, Tomari, and finally Omar as your imperfect form, and then you'd get it spelled with, we've seen this form enough that by now you should know what's going on here. Well, that's the explanation of it. And the argument for reading it as first person. And I said, what shall I cry? Which you got to admit makes more sense. Okay, we got to finish the text now. Oh, you're right. I mean, what constrains you from making this a while consecutive, huh?
Could it be with the participle that he was saying?
And a voice is, well, if you want to make it perfect while consecutive, I think then you have to link it up with the participle. But you could. A voice is saying, cry, and he or I or he was saying, that could work. Yeah, that could work. Good point. What shall I cry? Now we skipped the next two verses, didn't we? All the flesh is grass, and all its glory like the flower of the field. Katsir is grass. The katsir will dry out, and the flower will navel, will wilt, will fall. Navel is also the word for a corpse, a navelah. Because the ruach of Yahweh nashavs on it, blows on it. See, in Genesis 2, there it was the breath of Yahweh which give life. Therefore, the people is grass. Okay. Eight. The grass. With, I mean, you got two great lines of poetry with this kind of pedestrian, almost parenthesis in the middle of it. The grass withers, the flower fades, and then look at the comparison or the parallelism between the Ruach of Yahweh blows on it and the Devar Eloheinu Yachum Le'olam, right? And the word of our God will stand forever. Nine. Al Har Gavoah Ali Lach Mivasereth Zion. Upon a mountain, a high one. Gavoah is an adjective here, I think, modifying har. Gavoah can also be a noun for height, but I think here it's either height, mountain of height, which is another way of saying high mountain. Can you parse Ali? Kal imperative, singular, masculine, feminine, plural. Masculine, feminine, singular, plural. Pick two. You get two sides with your entree. What? Feminine singular. You're sure? How do you know it's feminine? There's got to be an answer to this. You can't just be guessing, right? This is why you actually study these things. It's because of the E ending, right? That's your feminine. You never thought you'd really see one, but here it is. Second singular feminine. Yiktol, tiktol, tiktol, tiktolee. Ektol. There it is. Get thee up. That lock is sort of a throw-in phrase. Get thee someplace. Often used with imperatives. So get thee up. And why is it feminine? Because it's being addressed to the Mivasereth Zion. To the evangelist. Can you parse Mivasereth? It's from the root Basar. Right? Basar means to proclaim, bring the news, and it better be good. Right? I mean, this is the guy huffing and puffing back from the battle to say, we won! That's what a Mivasereth is. Okay? We won! It'd be a great Easter. Just come running in with track suit on from the battle. Come from Marathon and just yell, we won! It's over. That's what a Mivasereth is. All right. Now, why is she feminine? Ordination of women. Why is Koheleth, Book of Ecclesiastes, otherwise translated as the preacher, a feminine participle? Women's ordination. I mean, I've actually heard this argument, so don't think I'm making this up just to be silly. Nouns of office in Hebrew are feminine. You just have to know enough about language to know that gender doesn't necessarily mean actual gender. Right? Just like cities are feminine, boats are feminine, countries are feminine, offices are feminine. So this is one who fills the office of evangelist, if you will. Just like Koheleth is one who fills the office of preacher, but it's sort of the abstraction. That's really what the feminine often does in Hebrew, is takes a specific noun and takes it up one level to sort of the abstraction. Not a particular person, but the office which would embody anybody who fills it or does that function. So that's what you got here. Oh, evangelist Zion. Now, the last question before I run out of time is, what's the relationship between Mivasereth and Sion? Just to do a little more exegesis here. Most people take this as a construct, which is, I think, the way it's translated, and is probably right. Oh, evangelist of Zion. Literally, which would mean what? O thou who tellest good tidings to Zion, the one who brings good news of or to or with reference to Zion. There's at least a second way that I think is intriguing and may well be right in this and a lot of other texts, and that's not as a construct chain but as an appositive, especially since Zion is also feminine. That is to say, O evangelist, i.e. Zion. Which is not the guy who brings the news, but describing Zion herself, if you will, as the people of God, as the evangelist. It's like we're all a corporate evangelist. One body that's proclaiming, screaming, crying out, we won. The good news. Either way works. Also in the second line, make high. Harimi is parset. Hifil, imperative, again feminine singular, root room, to be high. We saw room in Isaiah 6. Make high in the strength, bakoach, in the strength, your voice. O evangelist Jerusalem, or evangelist of Jerusalem. Make it high, do not be afraid, say to the cities of Judah, Hine Elohekem. Man, this is a great line. Behold your God. And let me accent the here and now-ness of the Hine, right? Here is, in fact, that'd be a good way of translating it. Here is your God. Remember, this is the people who were beaten down, didn't know if God still cared about them. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, may well have been destroyed. And yet, here's the proclamation that even in the midst of a theology of the cross, it's precisely at that point that we hold high the cross and say, Hine Elohekem. I did this once in chapel once. We had just gotten going on this passage, and I was the celebrant. So at that point when you say, the peace of the Lord be with you, and you hold up the elements, you know, that's really supposed to be the connection, not between each other, but between the body and blood of Christ. The peace of the Lord be with you. And I just said, Hine Elohekem. Huh? This is it, folks. Right here with us in the midst of life, here in body and blood through bread and wine, is your God. Now let me finish this off because I know we didn't do 10 and 11. Did we? Or did we? All right, real quick. Behold, Adonai Yahweh with strength will come, and his arm rules for him. What a picture of power, right? I just want to make that there's this rich contrast between 10 and 11. Because in 10, his hand and his arm are the symbol of power. Behold his reward, that's the result of his work. That's what a shakar is. His reward is with him. His work is before him. But now look at the image of the arm in verse 11. Like a shepherding guy, his sheep he shepherds. Roeh, Yahweh, Roeh. Roi, the Lord is my shepherd. Didn't we have Ra'ah in Exodus 3 when Moses was Ra'ahing the flock of Jethro? With Zeruah, again, you sort of have this connection to his arm. With his arm, he gathers the lambs, the Tilaim. Boy, how do you divide this line? Do you see? And in his lap, he lifts up the lambs. The Tilaim does double duty. It has to conclude the previous line, but it also begins this line. So where are you going to put it as you do your lineation here? It's sort of a swing word. Goes with both lines. For the sake of good scansion and setting these up at the same length, they put it in the second half. So what do we have? Like a shepherd, his sheep, his flock, he shepherds in his... With his arm, he gathers the lambs, and in his bosom, he lifts up the lambs. And, or does you make the break here, and say, and he lifts up, no, because here's another verb, right? And he leads the aloth. The aloth are the ones giving milk. Ool is to suck. So an ool would be a suckling, or an unweaned child. Here it's the mothers who are giving milk. So again, the women and children are the most vulnerable, and they're the ones that we care about the most, simply because they're the most vulnerable, especially when you're talking about women and young children. But I just love that contrast, you see, between the arm as the arm of strength, and the arm is the arm of tender compassion and care. Same God, same arm, but two powerfully different functions. Okay, so far the text.